And we say, well, it's not there. We invest in diagnosing it. And then we say it's rare. But because we say it's rare, we don't look for it. Therefore, we miss it. So we say it's rare. And it's like a positive feedback loop. And it's just bad PR. Fungus is common. Fungus is everywhere. Fungus is causing an incredible burden of disease. We just don't see it.
That's Dr. Andre Speck, a transplant infectious disease physician and the director of the Invasive Mycoses Clinic at Washington University. Welcome to the Core IM 5 Pearls podcast. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi, and I'm joined by...
I'm Sam Schutz, a resident physician at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And today we are talking all things invasive fungal disease.
All right, let's get started with the pearls we'll be covering today. Be sure to test yourself by pausing after each of the 5 questions. Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1. What is invasive fungal disease, and who is most at risk for developing it?
Pearl 2. What are the main classes of fungi?
Pearl 3. Fungal diagnostics. What are our options for testing for invasive fungal disease, and how good are these tests?
Pearl 4. How should we think about blood cultures and urine cultures when testing for fungal disease?
Pearl 5. What is the treatment of invasive fungal disease?
A quick word from our sponsor, Oakstone CME's ACP MixApp Audio Companion. How convenient would it be to have MixApp in your pocket, 11 minutes of SGLT2 inhibitors while you're walking or driving to work? That is something I can do. That's why ACP MixApp Audio Companion from Oakstone CME has been such a good go-to. For 50 years, Oakstone CME has been helping busy clinicians stay current with expert-led education free of outside commercial influence, from board prep to earning CME. They have a really mobile-friendly platform that offers trusted multimedia content designed for learning on the go. What I love is that each topic in MixApp is broken down into short, digestible, focused episodes, like think 10, 20 minutes per topic, just enough to learn something meaningful without needing a whole study session. It's seriously one of the easiest ways I found to stay sharp. Multitask while you absorb the latest medical knowledge with ACP MixApp Audio Companion, a podcast-style tool so you can listen at 1.5 or 2x speed, and it's packed with expert insights, board prep, and more CME credits than ever. Stream or download anytime. And exclusive to Core IM listeners, use the code CORE25 for 25% off. Go to oakstone.com/MixApp. That's oakstone.com/MKSAP, and use the code CORE25. And with that, let's get back into the episode.
You know, Sam, when you pitched the episode on invasive fungal disease, I thought, that's kind of a vague term. And maybe first and foremost, we should all be on the same page by what we mean by invasive fungal disease.
So I had the pleasure of sitting down with Dr. Michael Mansour, an infectious disease physician at MGH, who simplified things so beautifully.
And then the word invasive to me means it's crossed outside to inside. So, for example, we have candida normally on our skin, in our mouth, in our gut. So those are outside, you know. The minute you cross over into a bloodstream, deep tissue, I term you now invasive. You've now invaded into areas that should be sterile and free of fungi. That could be an abscess. It could be a bloodstream infection. Sometimes you see dissemination through the bloodstream and then multiple abscesses in different visceral organs. So the invasive, again, is an umbrella term. It can be, unfortunately, incredibly severe. It can be all just local invasion, or it could be really disseminated invasion with abscesses everywhere: brain, liver, kidney, spleen.
Wow, fungus is truly all among us.
Thank you for that poetic reference. Nice. All right. Well, I am genuinely so excited to learn about this. I feel like our patients are sicker more than ever, and we are seeing more and more invasive fungal disease. So this is quite pressing.
Yeah. And it's in part because we have so many treatments for cancer and for autoimmune disease. So that at-risk population just keeps growing.
Dr. Speck even went as far as to say, if you haven't seen fungus yet, it does not mean it has not seen you. Exactly, which is just so ominous. And it really made me wonder if I had missed it in my differential in the past.
Yeah, so that why don't we solidify when we should be having invasive fungal disease on our differential? And that really comes down to knowing who is at the highest risk.
And really, there's three big groups there. One is that team that caring for patients receiving chemotherapy. And their bone marrow is just slowly getting ablated as part of their treatment. And their white count's going down to zero. You know, that person is literally at risk in the hospital for translocation of candida from their normal reservoirs. Like we said, there's candida on the skin and in the gut. And so you worry that with disruption of the GI tract, with no immunity, you'll have candida move from inside the gut lumen to, let's say, the bloodstream.
So yes, chemotherapy is a big risk. But the main teaching here is basically any treatment that eliminates key aspects of our immune system puts people at risk. So think of the patient who has had a transplant, or they're taking certain T-cell or B-cell immunosuppressants, and of course, steroids.
And the classic teaching on steroids that I learned from the Five Pearls episode on it was that it's going to be someone who has been on steroids for more than 2 to 3 weeks on equivalent dose of 20 milligrams of prednisone or more, that's going to be at highest risk.
Yeah, and what I took away from that episode is the importance of chart reviewing to look for how many short courses of steroid a patient has been taking. Like, is this someone who comes in multiple times over the past several months and gets 5 days of steroids for COPD exacerbations?
Yeah. I think so many people can miss that, right? Frequent short bursts of steroids does increase your risk of adrenal insufficiency as well as invasive fungal disease. All right. So with that, on to the second major group who's at risk, people who've undergone major abdominal surgery.
The other big groups of patients are those who are undergoing abdominal or gastrointestinal surgery. So again, you're just disrupting that candida reservoir, the gut. Someone's going to manipulate your bowel and you're going through resections and re-anastomoses. So those individuals are at risk, one, for just mechanical spillage into the abdominal cavity. So they're at risk for abscesses that can end up being candida or direct inoculation into the bloodstream.
And the third being patients in the ICU. Think about people who have central lines, PICC lines, tubes, drains, lines for TPN.
And that really stems from the skin being a reservoir for candida. And then what do we do in the ICU? Is we start putting in very large caliber lines, plastic lines that go from skin with a direct conduit to the bloodstream. And candida certainly can crawl down and adhere to that plastic material, grow on that plastic, and then disseminate deep into that person.
So picturing candida crawling up lines, it makes sense that invasive candidiasis is the most common invasive fungal disease in non-neutropenic, critically ill patients in the ICU. But what's even crazier to me is that the mortality rate can be as high as 50% in patients presenting to the ICU with septic shock from candida.
Now, candida forms one of the best biofilms of all microbes. It sticks to plastic really well. It grows. It secretes lots of extracellular molecules that makes a little community, and that's biofilm. And those are very hard to get rid of. I'd say literally impossible. Without taking that line out and replacing it with a new one, I'd say nearly impossible to treat through. And that's why all guidelines say if you have candidemia, there really is no salvage of a line. It has to come out. And without it coming out, more studies show that your mortality is higher.
So that's the ICU, but I do remember on the general medicine wards, we had a patient who kept fevering despite broad-spectrum antibiotics.
And let me guess, someone threw out fungal disease on differential.
Of course. But the patient really didn't fit into those categories Dr. Mansour laid out. So I pressed our discussants if immunocompetent individuals can develop invasive fungal disease.
I can meet patients who, by all measures, have a normal BMI, they have no diabetes, they're not on steroids, they have a normal immune response, and yet they have an invasive aspergillus in their lung. And those tend to be anatomic issues. It's someone who has a history of bronchiectasis. from a previous infection. They've been left with airway structures that are not as open. Pulmonary toilet is not as good. I lump all of those individuals as anatomic sort of dysfunctions or problems. And so really, it's just a lack of clearance when it comes to secretions. And in those secretions, you can get overgrowth of many things, including fungi like Aspergillus, but also mycobacteria like MAC.
Oh, surprise. Plot twist, there is actually a fourth category, and it's patients who have some type of structural abnormality.
Yes, but the anatomic issue is really mostly in pulmonary patients.
Okay, so patients are less likely to get invasive fungal disease due to a urinary tract abnormality.
Exactly. So before we close out on this pearl, I sat down with Dr. Audrey Le Mahajan, a transplant infectious disease doc at BIDMC, to talk through the rap that fungal disease sometimes gets for being indolent.
And it often does present with fevers with no other clear localized signs of infection. Those can occur a little bit later. And so it's indolent, I would say, in the sense that, for example, a neutropenic patient who has invasive pulmonary aspergillosis might not have respiratory symptoms at all. But when they present with fevers and you scan their chest, there are diffuse nodularity lesions that make you worry about an invasive fungal infection. And I think a lot of that has to do with the host substrate that generally gets these infections is that their cell lines are so depleted that they don't have the typical inflammatory symptoms you would expect in a normal person.
I am loving all these explanations. There's so many good things clicking here. And maybe a good time to recap who is at the highest risk for invasive fungal disease. And this is going to be really important because in Pearl 3, we're going to talk about fungal studies, and it's all about sending in the right host. So we're going to be thinking about people who have in their one-liner some kind of suppressed immune system. Think chemotherapy, organ transplant. Maybe they're on some meds that end with MAB or NIB, and they have some history of prolonged steroids, or as Sam pointed out, multiple bursts of short courses of steroids.
And then also the people with recent major abdominal surgery, where there can be mechanical spillage of candida, or critically ill patients in the ICU where candida can form sticky biofilms in the lines they have. And the fourth surprise risk factor is pulmonary anatomic abnormality that really prevents these patients from clearing secretions as effectively.
All right, so before we get into interpreting different labs and then treatment, we need to have a good foundation on the different types of fungi, which I'll be honest, has never really stuck for me.
Same. But our experts helped us break things down in a very non-intimidating way, and we focused on just the most clinically relevant species under this fungus umbrella.
From a medical mycology perspective, I like to silo three major buckets. So the first bucket are the yeasts. These are obligate unicellular, you know, growth. So examples of those include some of the candida, not all the candida. So Candida glabrata is one of those. Cryptococcus. So Cryptococcus neoformans, Cryptococcus gattii. Those are obligate yeast. No matter where you grow them, how you grow them, for the most part, they're growing as single cells. They bud off each other, and then they'll make a daughter cell, the parent cell, but they're individual cells.
Okay. So the takeaway here is that the two major yeasts clinically are most candida, but not all, and Cryptococcus.
And just to give Cryptococcus some love, since we talked a lot about Candida in Pearl 1, Cryptococcus is usually inhaled and wreaks havoc in the lung, but the most feared complication is meningoencephalitis, and I feel like I'm always testing for it when I'm getting an LP.
Then we'll swing all the way over to the far bucket on the right, and that those are molds. Those are obligate multicellular organisms. They always grow together, bonded together.
And then what are the most common molds? Aspergillus and Mucormycetes are the most common molds that we see in terms of invasive mold disease.
There's a lot of Aspergillus spores in the air, and we all, in an estimated way, are breathing in, on average, about 100 spores per day. But of course, with normal immunity in our lungs, we would clear those spores and eliminate them. It's when you have anatomic issues or you have a compromised immune system that those spores now have a chance to really take root, germinate, make mold, and then cause problems. Many cases of individuals renovating their home, you know, so they'll tell me in the last month, we took down a wall, we were expanding the bedroom, we're adding this to the kitchen, And they don't even have to say they encountered mold, but the act of breaking down that structure or excavating to build out a basement, and they're unearthing the backyard, or they're gardening, or they're redoing the lawn, or they're out there working hard in the backyard or clearing brush out. They're sitting in the environment. They're growing in dark, kind of moist spaces. The spore density in the air at that moment is so high, you get exposed to those. And if you don't have a normal immune response, that's a perfect setup for having an invasive mold infection.
Oh man, I am soaking all of that up. And next time I'm worried about possible mold like aspergillus, I'll be asking about any recent home renovations. Do you work a lot with gardening or in the backyard? Or any other exposures to moist environments?
So far, we have on one end of the spectrum, we have yeast. That's going to be Candida, Cryptococcus. And then on the other end, we have mold, aspergillus, mucor. I was trying to think of some way to remember this. It's like yeast is CC, Candida, Crypto, and then mold is AM, aspergillus, mucor. I don't know if that helps, but somehow makes something a little bit more sticky. But we covered those two ends. So what's in that middle bucket under the fungal umbrella?
The middle are the dimorphics. And then the middle is dimorphics. And they're dimorphics because they morph their shape. They'll phase change between molds and yeast. So they sit in the middle. And for the most part, if you grow them at room temperature in a resource poor setting, there's not a lot of nutrients, there's not a lot of water and moisture, they may grow as molds. And that's what they'll grow in the soil outside. Their spores are released, just like aspergillus spores are released, and we inhale them. And once we inhale them, they actually can sense higher protein, temperature, moisture, and it'll turn on different genes and cause them to then germinate, not as mold, but as yeasts. And then they'll grow as single cell yeast in us.
Oh man, these dimorphic fungi, shapeshifters here. Funny thing is that all three of our reviewers had a handy rhyme. Mold in the cold and yeast in the heat to help make it stick.
Or some actually preferred mold in the cold, yeast in the beast, which I actually prefer.
It's a little twisted.
So who are these dimorphics? These fungi include our endemic mycoses that we all took step questions on. Histoplasma, coccidioides, and blastomyces.
I remember these questions too well, and I think it was always about figuring out what region of the country was on the question stem as a clue. And I don't know, is that really true anymore with climate change?
Another issue that I think we're seeing with a lot of endemic infections is that they're no longer respecting their geographic borders anymore. So like histoplasmosis kind of being in the Texas, Ohio, Mississippi, River Valley areas was no longer the case. I test for histoplasmosis very often for patients who are basically from anywhere on the East Coast. And so like endemic fungi are no longer just where they're supposed to be. And it then is leading us having to think about it more often in patients we wouldn't necessarily do so. And then it also leads to misdiagnoses because you don't expect it.
On the topic of misdiagnosis, I was surprised to learn from our experts that the CDC is now recommending us to test for dimorphic fungi in patients with pneumonia who have failed just one round of antibiotics.
Wait, what? Really? So, I mean, that's like a ton of patients, right? Because, I mean, so many patients come in with pneumonia after not getting better from one round of antibiotics, and it definitely has not been on my radar to send off a histoantigen, blastoantigen, and a coccidioides.
So technically, you don't need to send all of these. The CDC still recommends that you test based on the travel history or where the patient is living if they're in one of these endemic areas. But we know, of course, that these areas are growing.
Okay, so don't go sending off everything on everyone unless they've traveled to all the regions of America or elsewhere. All right, Sian, this has been good so far. Let us recap all things on the different fungi.
Yes. So to recap this pearl on the different types of fungi, and remember, we're using fungi as the umbrella term. There are yeasts, which are Candida and Cryptococcus. There are molds with aspergillus and mucor. And then in the middle of those two ends are the dimorphic fungi, which can shapeshift between the two buckets. And these are the endemic mycoses.
And we just want to call out the paradox here. On one hand, our discussants are telling us we have to be so judicious about the fungal markers we send and make sure it's on the right host.
Yeah. And at the same time, we also want to broaden our differential of who the right host is because our patients are sicker and more complex. And on top of that, our environment is changing. So on one hand, we want to keep our eyes as wide open as possible for fungi and still be thoughtful on who we're sending fungal studies on.
Okay, now say we do have the right host, we have a good pretest probability for fungal disease. What tests are we sending off? Are we sending off beta-D-glucan, galactamine on everyone, throw in some cryptoantigens and some other things?
So before we go sending tests, let's start by understanding the basics of the fungal cell wall. This actually helps me remember the fungal tests and the targets of the antifungals. So the cell wall consists of an outer layer of proteins, followed by a middle layer of beta-glucan.
So for the most part, we see a positive galactamanin. Probably you should think, oh, there's aspergillus somewhere.
So if beta-glucan is in the cell wall of fungi, then it's probably like the broadest test we have in terms of fungal stuff. Basically like a pan-fungal marker.
Exactly. But beta-D-glucan is not a perfect test.
Beta-D-glucan is inherent within most fungal cell walls. It is not present, however, in high amounts in three specific fungi, Blastomyces, Mucorales, and Cryptococcus.
Ah, it was too good to be true. Beta-D-glucan won't help us in Blasto, Mucorales, and Crypto. And I'm guessing that's because things like Blasto and Crypto just have a different cell wall that doesn't have as much beta-glucan.
Yep. And then on the flip side, there are a lot of causes of false positives for beta-D-glucan.
So you do, again, have to be careful because if somebody had invasive candidiasis, a glucan would be positive, but it could also be positive in somebody with just thrush, for example. And so that's why it's sensitive for quite a few different fungal entities.
And you have to ask yourself, did my patient get IVIG or albumin in the last couple of weeks? Did my patient get certain antibiotics, especially IV beta lactams? Did my patient recently have dialysis?
Dialysis? Really? I mean, like half my patients usually are on dialysis. Does this mean we should just be avoiding sending beta-D-glucan in end-stage renal disease patients?
That is the consensus. It's the dialysis membranes that have cellulose that changes the beta-D-glucan levels. But of course, the caveat is that there are newer dialysis membranes that won't cause this problem.
Okay, so it sounds like the general thought is avoid sending beta-D-glucan in end-stage renal disease patients or interpret with caution, unless you're sure you're at a place that has modern synthetic membranes for dialysis, fancy smancy places, or just ask your nephrologist if that's the case.
The other thing that was good learning is that when the beta-D-glucan does come back positive, it's that it's not a binary positive or negative. In fact, our ID friends actually look at the number, and especially when it comes back very high.
Like false positives can only account for so much. Like somebody getting dialysis, their dialysate membrane is only going to make their beta-D-glucan positive to a small degree, not be greater than 500. So you have to wonder why certain patients have really elevated fungal marker.
That's good to know. I'm not sure if I've ever peaked at the beta-D-glucan level, so that's something I'm definitely going to start to look at more. All right, I feel like we covered really good ground on beta-D-glucan. I feel like I've finally understood that test. Sam, walk us through galactamanin.
So galactamanin measures a carbohydrate component of the fungal cell wall that's found in Aspergillus, Histoplasma, and Fusarium species.
You know, I hadn't appreciated for the longest that galactamanin was so specific for just a few fungi. Histo, Fusarium, and I guess the popular one being Aspergillus.
I think the bigger issue is that it's not very sensitive in general. So it can be negative in individuals who do have invasive pulmonary aspergillosis, but the sensitivity for the galactamanin can be extremely low in some circumstances. So the galactamanin is more specific than the beta-D-glucan, but the issue with it that we deal with is that it can be falsely positive in certain scenarios. And the literature has shown that it can be positive after receipt of certain antimicrobials. So that would be Zosyn or Unicin. I mean, honestly, many, many antimicrobials have been implicated as being reasons for false positive.
So our tests for fungal disease come with their confounding limitations. And just like beta-D-glucan, the amount of positivity for galactamanin matters. And so does where the sample you're running a galactamanin on came from.
So the Aspergillus galactomannan assay usually has a cutoff value of 0.5. And when it's anywhere above that, it reads off as positive. When we test it within the serum, 0.5 is the cutoff that we generally use to say that this is a positive test for Aspergillus. And you should think about it as, you know, as a patient having possible aspergillosis. But the cutoff when you send it from a BAL sample, for example, I would consider using a higher cutoff, and therefore ranges between 0.5 to 1 are more susceptible to being a false positive. And I would consider something above 1 to be more consistent with true Aspergillus infection. I feel like the data is pretty strong that beta-D-glucans and Aspergillus galactomannans that are sent from sera in the right host in hematologic malignancy patients has pretty good diagnostic accuracy, has pretty good. So ballpark sensitivity in patients with hematologic malignancy is still within the 70 to 80. It's still not incredibly high, but it's reasonable. Specificity is higher, and it depends on also where you're obtaining the galactomannan from, so whether it's serum or bronchoalveolar lavage galactomannan, and then if you're using a higher cutoff. So I like to think of these fungal markers as more of a continuous result instead of looking at it as a beta-D-glucan is detected or not. Similarly, the galactomannan, there are cutoff points for which you say somebody does have a positive galactomannan or not, but I do look at the numeric value in those tests.
Okay, so pay attention to where your sample came from. For BAL fluid, you need a higher cutoff. Think above 1. And for serum, think above 0.5.
Yeah, I think this reminds me of the fact that I think a lot of us have fallen into a rabbit hole chasing a positive galactomannan that ends up being nothing. And I think it's, again, warts and spaced repetition about being so judicious on who we send off the galactomannan on, like really thinking like who is really at risk for histoplasmosis and more commonly Aspergillus.
Who's that patient? So that patient really needs to have the risk factors for invasive Aspergillus. And that person is someone with anatomic dysfunction. So this is your advanced COPD patient, advanced bronchiectasis. Another cohort are those with neutropenia or neutrophil dysfunction. So anybody on the BMT service, anybody undergoing induction therapy with leukemia, admitted with leukemia, all of those patients are at high risk for invasive Aspergillus by virtue of lack of neutrophils. By losing neutrophils, and coming in with leukemia is a loss of neutrophils. Your neutrophils have been replaced by tumor. And then solid organ transplant patients, so especially lung transplant patients, are at incredibly high risk for invasive Aspergillus. Sometimes that Aspergillus is found growing on the anastomosis between the large airways being anastomosed to the donor lungs. And I think when we don't have that, we end up spending a lot of money and a lot of effort running galactomannans, and they make zero impact. It ends up costing the hospital and the healthcare system a lot, and we make no impact whatsoever.
Okay, so now that is loud and clear, I just want to add, on top of finding the right host, you know, something else that might raise your pretest probability is if there is some concern on imaging, for example, like a deep-seated infection, that would definitely warrant some further investigation. And so now that we went over common fungal markers, Sam, can you walk us through what else we have in our arsenal?
Of course. So there are a few other specific fungal antigen tests. So you'll have to actually type out the antigen test for specific fungi like blasto, histo, cocci, and cryptococcus. There is some antigen test cross-reactivity between the different endemic infections. So I definitely appreciate infectious disease specialist input on these things.
Okay, good to know. Sounds like we have some antigens. What about PCR? PCR is usually pretty good in most things. So is it also helpful in invasive fungal disease?
So there are some PCRs that can help us detect Candida and different ones for Aspergillus, but it's not like their sensitivity and specificities are foolproof. One meta-analysis we found for Aspergillus PCR showed a sensitivity of 85% and a specificity of 76%. And then on top of the mediocre test characteristics, there aren't standardized methods of validation of these PCR assays yet.
Bummer. Okay. So we've covered a lot of good ground. Let's summarize some salient points. So beta-D-glucan is our broad fungal marker, but heads up, it's not going to catch blastomycosis, mucorales, and cryptococcus because their cell walls are just built differently. And then on the flip side, we have to watch out for false positives, right? Asking, is our patient on IVIG, albumin, certain antibiotics like Bactrim, Cefepime, or are they on dialysis with that old school cellulose membrane? That can definitely lead the beta-D-glucan to be a bit misleading. I think the pro tip here is that the actual numbers can be helpful, right? A slightly positive could be nothing, but if it's over, say, something like 500, then fungal disease could definitely be brewing.
Now about galactomannan. This one is more specific for Aspergillus, Histoplasma, and Fusarium. But honestly, it's not super sensitive, and tons of antibiotics can cause false positives, especially those frontline sepsis drugs like Piptazo. And please, don't go ordering galactomannan on everyone. Save it for the patients who actually have risk factors. Severe COPD, neutropenia, blood cancers, or transplants.
For specific fungi, there are antigen tests like Blasto, Histo, Coxi, and Crypto have them, but they can cross-react with each other. And then there is PCR that exists, but isn't that great in terms of sensitivity, specificity, and then there's also limits in terms of validation and standardization.
And just to say it out loud, if your pretest probability is high for fungal disease and you are looking in the right host, do not stop the workup just because the test is negative.
I am so excited to have EchoCore 500 Digital Stethoscope as a sponsor. I actually learned about them accidentally a year or so ago when I'd forgotten my stethoscope and my resident let me borrow his, and I just was like, wow, I've never heard heart sounds or lung sounds this clearly. You just get this extra level of confidence for those moments where you're asking, was that faint crackles? Was that an S3 gallop? And so that's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies sounds 40x, and then on top of that, it has noise cancellation so you can really hear with precision in a noisy ED or with a really loud roommate or other environments. Echo AI is also built in and helps you detect murmurs and AFib earlier. A cool thing also is that you can record that heart sound that you heard, share it later with your team, or on a case presentation. And then you can really trust the diagnostic accuracy. It's backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for the devices and the AI algorithms. So those who use Echo are twice as likely to catch heart disease. What I think is neat is that Echo 500 isn't just the digital stethoscope. You can actually also get an EKG tracing right on the app when you place an Echo 500 on a patient's chest. So no more waiting around trying to trace down the EKG machine on the floor. I trust Echo so much that I work with a team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/corium. Your purchase will be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you're going to detect heart and lung sounds more confidently, and if you don't, you can return it with a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/corium for $50 off plus a free chest cover. That's ekohealth.com/corium. And with that, let's get back into the episode. Here at Corium, we're talking about the real things that can help anyone who works in healthcare. And today, we're talking about how the scrubs you wear, they can make a difference. I remember the first time I saw one of my colleagues walking into a sign-out room looking way more put together after a night shift, and I knew right then and there they were wearing FIGS. FIGS scrubs are made specifically for doctors, residents, students, and healthcare professionals like us. We're putting in long hours, and we need gear that can keep up and perform at our level. We're already doing so much in a given shift, and I think what we wear and our scrubs is the last thing we need to think about. That's why FIGS are lightweight, stretchy, breathable. Plus, they have all the small touches that have really made me a convert. The fit is clean, modern, and also super functional. Tons of pockets, which I love for snacks. They have zippers that don't snag, and plus antimicrobial fabric to stay healthy while working in the clinic or the hospital. You deserve better scrubs. You deserve FIGS. So head over to wearfigs.com and enter FIGSRX at the checkout for 15% off your first purchase. That's wearfigs.com, promo code FIGSRX for 15% off your first order. And with that, let's get back to the episode. So we talked a lot about lab testing. Let's switch over to the other tab in the EMR. Usually it's the next tab, I think, and go to the micro section.
And so if I meet someone in the ICU, ongoing fevers, ongoing pressure requirements, you know, unable to wean off. There's no obvious source. We've imaged. There's nothing really obvious to explain that. I think thinking about Candida should definitely be on that differential. What can you send? Here's the problem. Our diagnostics for fungi are poor. You know, so for Candida, a blood culture has a 50% sensitivity. You know, there's lots of studies. Some go down to 10% sensitivity. Some will say 80, but the average and what we teach is 50%. So you're missing a lot of Candida.
50% sensitivity? That's like flipping a coin on blood cultures catching Candida.
So remember, Candida is really sticky and it makes biofilms. And so sometimes the blood cultures won't catch it. So think about Candida in a patient who is still sick and fevering despite many days of antibiotics and blood cultures are negative.
One trick people like to do is then do repeat blood cultures. And so then at least you're increasing your chance of catching a candidemia. That said, you know, I think if you have three sets of blood cultures in my practice and in my opinion, and none of them are positive, I mean, I think you've exhausted your blood.
I really appreciate that rule of thumb to increase our yield on catching Candida. And if you do catch Candida in the blood, that is a hard stop.
I don't generally think of a positive Candida culture, a positive growth of Candida from any culture as being immediately a knee-jerk reason for starting antifungal, unless it's from the blood. In that case, call ID, you have a problem. And I would never consider that to be a contaminant.
Okay. So no hand waving that some early yeast growth in the blood is some contaminant. Let's shift to urine cultures. I think we've all been there, an altered patient, some bump in the white count, low-grade fever, and then the culture comes back, few yeasts in the urine. And the question here is, do we go towards treatment or trash that result?
I would think about treating positive Candida in urine if somebody has recently been transplanted, has undergone a recent kidney transplant. Otherwise, there are not many times that I would say that somebody should get fluconazole even for Candida growth in the urine, unless it was truly symptomatic to them. Usually that's a colonizer.
Okay. And then what about respiratory samples? I think we've also all been here, right? Looking at a sputum culture or a BL report that says some quote unquote yeast.
Candida growth in the lungs is very common. And so we're often presented with scenarios where a patient had a BAL for whatever reason, and there's Candida on one or two specimens. Candida doesn't generally cause invasive pulmonary fungal infection. And so there are almost no scenarios where I would treat a positive Candida culture from the lung.
Now, throw back to Pearl 2, yeast is going to be Candida and Crypto, CC. And that is different from mold like Aspergillus, which likes to really make a home in the lungs.
So the next time I'm hovering over the microtab of my immunocompromised fevering patient, I'll be asking not just what organism, but from where, because context is a big deal in the fungal world.
Let's recap some of the more granular takeaways. For patients with a fever, with no source, but maybe some lines as a risk factor, I'm going to keep Candida on my radar, but won't rule it out if blood cultures come back negative, and maybe I'll send off multiple sets to increase my sensitivity. And if the blood culture does come back positive for fungi, that definitely warrants attention and an ID consult.
And those few yeast reports in urine, unless it's someone with a kidney transplant or my patient has textbook UTI symptoms, I'm leaving it alone.
Yes. And then as for BAL results showing up as Candida, I'm practically never treating that now. It's almost always colonization and not invasion. All right. I am so excited to dive into all things fungal treatment because I feel like I learned it so many times. It never stuck for me. And thank you to our discussants as well as Sam for finally having something stick.
Yes. So to understand the treatment, we do have to do some spaced repetition back to our three big fungal families, the yeasts, molds, and dimorphics. It will also be helpful to remember the fungal cell wall so we can picture our antifungals at work. So as a reminder, the cell wall consists of an outer layer of proteins, followed by a middle layer of beta-glucan, and the innermost layer, which is a polysaccharide and ergosterol membrane.
Great. So with that background, I am ready to re-tackle, or should I say restructure, the antifungals that we have in our arsenal.
The big buckets of antifungals that we have readily available are the azoles, everything that ends with azole. You know, the ketoconazoles, the fluconazoles, voriconazole, all these azoles block the production of ergosterol. So in our cells, we keep our membranes fluid with cholesterol. Fungal cells use ergosterol. It's a cousin of cholesterol, right? So it's a related molecule, and they rely on that. And so all azoles do is block production of ergosterol. So you poison that machinery, you don't make it.
So azoles essentially starve the fungi of their cholesterol cousin. Okay, now on to the second bucket of our fungal defenders.
The second big bucket are all the polyenes, like amphotericin. Amphotericin and like nystatin, oral nystatin, swish and spit, those integrate into the membrane. They bind to ergosterol. They don't inhibit its production. They bind to it, and they can disrupt the membrane that way.
Great. So rather than blocking production, polyenes like amphotericin and nystatin kind of punch holes into the fungal membrane. Then last but not least, what is our third weapon on hand?
And then the third bucket are echinocandins. Examples of echinocandins are mycofungin, caspofungin. And echinocandins inhibit a specific enzyme called beta-glucan synthase. So you don't make beta-glucan. And many fungi rely on that inner layer of beta-glucan for structural support and protection. So without that layer, that's how you deliver killing there.
So mycofungin and caspofungin are essentially destroying the structural support that has beta-glucan. But Sam, which drug works best for which fungus?
So before we get into that, let's just preface this by saying we're going to talk about what agents are generally first line. But of course, trust and know your own hospital's local ecology and your local microdata.
Really old, you have your old version of azoles. We dial back to like the ketoconazoles and the fluconazoles. Those were some of the early azoles. Those only covered yeast. That was it. It was just yeast.
Okay. And then for some spaced repetition, because my gosh, anything micro related needs it. What are the types of fungi under the yeast umbrella?
The classic yeast duo is Candida and Cryptococcus that fluconazole was built to fight.
And then you have the echinocandins. And the echinocandins, their big unfortunate gap is mold. It's a second line agent at best for mold activity. And so there, an echinocandin, that's your workhorse yeast. You know, it's Candida, it's some of the dimorphics. But the minute you step into like the mold territory, echinocandins sort of like fail. They're second line agents.
So echinocandins like mycofungin and caspofungin are going to be our go-to for candidemia, especially when we might suspect some azole-resistant candidemia. And that's why ID often recommends in patients who have any kind of port of entry, say someone on chemo, abdominal surgery, those central lines in the ICU. And if they have candidemia, go for mycofungin or caspofungin.
Great. So to recap where we are so far, early azoles like ketoconazole and fluconazole are good for the yeast umbrella. Within that, if we're going to try to fight some invasive Candida, especially candidemia, we will reach for the echinocandins like mica and caspo because they're broader, especially when somebody is very sick. Of course, later when sensitivities return, we may be able to step down to azole therapy for candidemia.
Great. And then we talked a lot about early azoles, and I've seen a lot of my patients where ID recommended voriconazole or posaconazole. I've even had a bunch of patients go home on once-a-day econazole.
And then you get into the itraconazoles, and now later vori, posa, and isavuconazole. Then you add to the yeast coverage molt. So you're getting much broader spectrum coverage with the later azoles. And if you're now confident that you have a probable aspergillus infection, here IDSA guidelines, as of now, say that the agent of choice is an azole. An azole is the agent of choice, and that agent of choice is voriconazole.
So the later azoles are great broad-spectrum agents. And what is it that makes the later all azoles? Ooh, ooh, okay. And, and what is it that makes these later azoles like vori more broad? It's that they help us cover mold in addition to yeast.
So voriconazole may be our aspergillus superhero, but if I've learned anything with playing pretend superhero with my four-year-old, every superhero does have their kryptonite. So I'm curious, what are the side effects we should warn our patients about before they walk out the door with a prescription of voriconazole?
One, the photosensitivity, if this is summertime, can be pretty intense. I've had patients who have, you know, started voriconazole and then walked from their car through a parking lot to a store, to a grocery store, and that little bit of sun exposure has caused them sunburns. It's a really intense, it's sort of the same counseling we give patients if they're on doxycycline. You really need to counsel, so long sleeves or sunscreen while you're on voriconazole, especially in the summer months. Other things are you may get some visual hallucinations, you may see some different types of dreams, and all those kind of resolve on their own. Other things are bone pain, which are longer term things. So bone pain, because of high fluoride content, is something that's a large issue. And then things that lab work will hopefully catch before you see onset of symptoms. Hepatitis, you can see some kidney dysfunctions and other things. But these are all things that, you know, if someone needs to be on long-term voriconazole, we're screening with blood work.
Sunburns, hallucinations, bone pain, vori packs a real punch. Our pharmacy reviewers taught me that the weird dreams and visual effects from vori can be related to serum levels that are just too high. Fortunately, this can be fixed with dose adjustment.
Nice. I am glad that's the case. And then onto posaconazole, it has its own challenges, liver issues, GI upset. But I think the bigger headaches are just the day-to-day things.
I would say nowadays, the QT, drug-drug interactions, and then insurance coverage, like who's going to pay for this, for these drugs, are the three things we sort of juggle.
And of those, I think drug interactions are a minefield. So we asked discussants, what are some of the major drug-drug interactions we should be anticipating before a pharmacy pays us?
So things I worry about, you know, seeing transplant patients are the calcineurin inhibitors like tacrolimus. You can absolutely skyrocket tacrolimus levels starting in azole. And then someone says, oh, okay, we're done. Aspergill is treated. Now we're going to stop the posaconazole. And so then they unfortunately end up being at risk for a rejection episode because now the tacrolimus level just bottoms out and we haven't resumed their normal dose pre the azole. You have to just be incredibly careful with anti-seizure medications, pain medications, entry like opioids, methadone, for example, you know, is a QT prolong.
And last but definitely not least, the nuclear option of antifungals, the one we all respect and fear in equal measure, the polyenes, particularly amphotericin.
It's hard to get a good antifungal that doesn't also happen to be a good antihuman. So amphotericin is kind of the old one, the polyene. It is still the best antifungal we've ever made. Nothing kills fungus good like amphotericin does. The problem with it is that it's also a pretty good anti-human. So amphotericin is IV. It is toxic. It is difficult to manage in terms of kidney and infusion reactions, but it does work really well. And it tends to be my go-to drug for most serious cases.
Amphoterapal really earned its nickname, honestly, but it does remain our go-to for the most serious infections like cryptococcal meningitis and mucormycosis. Fortunately, nowadays, we have the liposomal form of amphotericin, called AmbiZome, which is much less toxic than the original formulation.
Yes and yes. Let's wrap up on all things antifungal with a recap. So in our antifungal arsenal, we have a trinity, azoles, echinocandins, and polyenes. The newer azoles like vori and posaconazole tackle tough molds like aspergillus. The older azoles like fluconazole really crush the yeast, crypto, and candida, especially when you're talking about superficial candida or candida that we know to be sensitive to azoles.
But who is the true candida workhorse, aka the empiric big guns that treat candidemia and deep-seated infections? This is when we reach for echinocandins, like mycofungin and caspofungin. And amphotericin, the fungal nuclear option, effective against almost everything, but at a possible significant cost to the host.
Great. And I think what I loved learning the most about was what we should be counseling our patients on when they go home with voriconazole, keeping in mind to tell people, hey, you know, make sure you wear long sleeves to avoid sunburns. Let us know if you have any visual hallucinations or any bone pain, because thankfully we have wonderful colleagues that can help adjust some doses for us. And that is a wrap for today's episode. If you got something of value from this podcast, our ask is to please, please share it with at least one other colleague who might also get something out of this episode too.
Thank you to our reviewers, Drs. Matt Lee and Todd McCarty, and pharmacist Kendall Bell. Thank you to Amy Moo for the accompanying graphics. This episode was made as a part of the digital education track at BIDMC.
opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.